Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benouli. Today we have Alastair McLeod and Jayant Bhandari. Alastair is head of research for Gold Money and an Austrian economist. He has a background as a stockbroker, banker, and fund manager. And Jayant is constantly traveling the world looking for investment opportunities, particularly in the natural resource sector. He advises institutional investors about his finds. And he's worked 6 years for U.S. Global Investors in San Antonio, Texas, a boutique natural resource firm, and for 1 year with KC Research. Welcome, gentlemen.
It's nice to be here.
Nice to be here, Richard.
Great. So I thought today we'd do a focus on the international currency markets, what's happening around the world in terms of currencies, physical cash, gold, the relationship between those, and trends that you see. Perhaps first we can look at India, what's happening in India. We've had a number of updates from Jayant. Just wondering what you're currently seeing, Jayant?
Richard, every morning I wake up and there is new story coming out of India. And as I have repeatedly said in the past, India is very rapidly becoming a police state. In the last budget, which came out a month back, government announced that any cash transaction over 300,000 rupee, which is about $4,500, would no longer be legal. Any transaction above that amount, according to them, has to be through the banking system. But they came out with an amendment yesterday, and they actually have come out with about 40 amendments the last few days. The latest amendment says that the cash transaction limit is now set to 200,000 rupees, which is $3,000. If you transact using cash more than 200,000 rupees, you will be penalized with the same amount that you try to transact with.
Wow.
Now, this is an absolutely crazy situation in a country where 96% of transactions are cash transactions.
And there's also some other developments in terms of political developments in Uttar Pradesh, the biggest and most populated province, that might also cause problems as well in all of this.
Richard, last week, Uttar Pradesh, which is the biggest province of the country and which basically decides on who runs the federal government as well, usually that has been the case in the past, that state elected BJP into power. And then Modi appointed Yogi Adityanath as the head of the state. And Yogi Adityanath is an Hindu extremist. He is a person who has openly and publicly asked for killing hundreds of Muslims for every Hindu killed. He has used that kind of languages. And already in the last 3 days that he has been the chief minister, they have now been arresting men who are walking around with women. So he's establishing a very backward kind of law and order situation in the province. And a few Muslim shops have been burnt down in the last 2 days. So this is going to very easily escalate into something very bad. And I hope that doesn't happen. Remember, in 1991, there was a destruction of a mosque in Uttar Pradesh, which Hindu extremists wanted to convert into a temple. And now that a Hindu extremist is in power, he has no choice but to convert that mosque into a temple. This is a very, very delicate situation for India, in my view.
And how is all of this playing into gold? So are there any trends that you're seeing there in India in terms of the price of gold, demand for gold, physical gold supplies, any regulations affecting gold? Any thoughts on that?
In my view, the gold demand is very subdued even today. And the reason is that people don't really have access to cash to buy gold. The lineups are more than 50% of ATMs still do not have cash. There are still lineups outside the banking system. Banks are clogged with people. And this means that people don't really have cash to buy gold. In my view, at the same time, Richard, the economy is stagnating. And in a negative yielding environment, which has historically been the case, people have a tendency to buy gold. So there is, in my view, an increased tendency to buy gold, except that people just don't have access to their own cash.
So still definitely part of the financial system in terms of a role for gold.
Well, much more going forward, I guess, because in a police system, people will trust their institutions even less than they have in the past. And now tax authorities have the right to enter your house without a reason. They still have to have a warrant. But the whole institutional climate is such that savers and businessmen are extraordinarily afraid of the state, which is happening in India in my lifetime for the first time. And this will increase people's interest in gold or in moving their money outside the country.
And Alistair, you've recently written an essay, Central Banks and Gold, where you note that there's likely to be a sea change in central banks' attitude to gold allocation in their reserves and sort of having gold come back in, as a role in the financial system. Could you elaborate on that? Why this may be happening and what you see as the trend?
Yes. I mean, the reason this is happening, Richard, is that China is basically getting rid of dollars in order to stockpile the commodities it needs for its development plans over Asia. China will spend huge amounts of resources, deploy huge amounts of resources in developing not just the Silk Roads, but also all the associated infrastructure, the industrial revolution that China will be bringing in effect, sort of trans-Asia. We're talking about a massive 20-year project. And the point about disposing of her dollars in order to do this is that as she does that, she will be effectively selling dollars down against the price. Now, the problem that other central banks who will be dealing with China has is that they will have to try and match to some degree the pace at which the Chinese central bank, the People's Bank of China, disposes of its dollars and adds to her gold. So you can see that one way or the other, central bank demand is being driven into gold. They also have the problem that if you're looking at fiat currencies, instead of the dollar, where else do you go? Do you go and buy the euro? The political situation in Europe suggests that currency might not exist in its current form within a 2 to 3 year time frame. Do you buy the yen? Probably yes. But the problem with yen is that you've got negative yields and you don't necessarily want to have, Japanese government bonds, which effectively yield either zero, nothing, or very, very little. There is not a lot of choice for the Asian central banks. So if you look at someone, for example, like Thailand, if they just adjusted their portfolio, it probably means that they would have to pick up 60 tons of gold. Now, 60 tons of gold, just to adjust the portfolio by a figure like 10%, the reserve portfolio, you can't just walk into the market and buy 60 tons of gold easily. And it's not just them, it's various other people. So you can see, I think, that there is an underlying tendency for central banks to sell dollars in order to buy gold. And then on top of this, we have the trade situation. The trade situation is interesting because last weekend, the G20 finance ministers met in Germany at a place called Baden-Baden, they agreed in their final communique to drop the traditional reference to the desire for free trade. Now, this is very important. This is something that came from the Americans. Mm-hmm. The Americans are changing the terms of global trade. They are moving away from from trade agreements. They're moving away from WTO-mandated minimums, as it were. And consequently, they're really, what the Americans are saying is, we're going to run trade the way we want to run trade. We don't care what anyone else's rules say. Now, this is important because it's rather like the Smoot-Hawley problem that we had. Smoot-Hawley was the Tariff Act that was brought in January 1930 yes. Under President Herbert Hoover. Mm-hmm. And at that time, there were already some fairly high levels of tariffs, particularly protecting agricultural products. And the tariffs there were up to 40%. The Smoot-Hawley legislation was on top of that. The effect of the Smoot-Hawley legislation was to drive the whole world into a depression. In those days, money was backed by gold, and bank credit was contracting, and as the bank credit contracted, obviously prices fell. This time round, it'll be different. This time round, bank credit will be increased, or the quantity of narrow money will be increased one way or the other by the central banks, so that the money result will be different. But the underlying result in terms of real trade will be the same. The American moves, it seems to me, will lead to a contraction in global trade. The Chinese are more or less protected from this because they're already moving their emphasis away from selling cheap goods to countries like America into developing the Asian continent. But the rest of us are going to have a problem. And as trade contracts, as the volumes of trade contract in the coming years, as you know, all the work that the World Trade Organization has done to reduce tariffs to an average of less than 10%, which is really quite remarkable when you think about it, as that happens and trade, global trade diminishes, dollars will be returning home. And they will be returning home at the same time as the central banks, and particularly Asian central banks, will be trying to reduce their exposure to the dollar. So really, net-net, what I am seeing is, what I believe is happening, is that we are at the peak value of the dollar at the moment in terms of its purchasing power. Its purchasing power from here, I think, has got one way to go, and that is down. The other side of that coin, obviously, is the price of gold, measured in dollars, is going to go up, and I think it could go up quite sharply.
Yeah, and you mentioned in your essay that it's not just China, it's most exporting nations that are revolving around the Sino-Russian trade, right, in terms of those nations turning into sellers of dollars.
Exactly. I mean, this goes as far as countries like Saudi Arabia, for example. Saudi Arabia do not export any meaningful quantities of oil to America. Their market is now Asia. You know, they export to India, they export to China. They don't like Iran, obviously, but Iran are doing exactly the same thing. Iran is marketing her oil in conjunction with Russia. So suddenly what we have got is a situation where the Asian or the Eurasian continent landmass is now the most important economic driver in the world. And America is receding into the distance. She's following an autarkic trade approach. She is withdrawing, if you like, in the sense that she is no longer respects the relationships of the past that has led to the growth of international trade. And I think that this is such an important thing. The consequences of this are not really fully understood, and it will take time for us to really sort of work this one out. But what I do see is that the importance, if you like, of Asia in terms of overall trade is now becoming paramount. Already, China's trade with Asia exceeds her exports to America. So you can see how the whole thing is shifting. And the idea that the Americans can somehow call on the Chinese and say, you've got it, you know, this is unfair trade and all the rest of it, which, of course, is the sort of approach they're likely to take. As far as China is concerned, they're getting to the point where they can actually walk away and say, well, all right, America, you make your own arrangements. We don't care. They're not quite there, but they're getting that way. They need also to reduce the redeploy the labor, which is currently manufacturing cheap goods, into her new objectives, which is the development, the further development of her own economy. She wants to move 200 million people from urban districts into new cities. She's expanding her middle class. I mean, this is a country, this is the most populous country in the world, bar India, which is going upmarket. And we're missing this. We don't understand this. We really just think that, you know, America still runs the world. No longer. This is changing. And I think Mr. Trump is going to find that the world is not quite as he thinks it is.
Yeah, it's really only been the last 200 years out of the last 2000 where the combined GDP of India and China have not been greater than the rest of the world. So it's sort of reversion to the mean is happening.
Yeah, exactly. And what's so interesting, I mean, you're in Canada. The natural North American partner for China is, of course, Canada.
Yeah, exactly, for especially raw materials, commodities.
Not only that, but Trudeau Senior was the first, I think he was the first Canadian to really go over to China and form the, if you like, the diplomatic bonds, which persist to this day.
Yeah. And Jiayet being generally based in Asia, like Singapore, I believe, are you seeing similar types of trends?
Well, as far as China is concerned, I've had an extremely optimistic view about China. And I think a lot of negative opinion that financial market has about China is not something I agree with. Now, what I want to add here is that American dollar can actually continue to be very strong in the near term. And the reason is that while American dollar is fiat currency, and I fully agree that it's overvalued, the problem is that a lot of these emerging markets in South Asia, Middle East, Africa, Latin America are facing huge amount of financial and economic problems. These people have taken on too much of private and public debt, which means that compared to American dollar, their paper currency has even less value in the future. As a result, the locals in these countries still prefer to own American dollar if they can get hold of those American dollars. So if I had extra cash, I would buy gold. But I still think that American dollar can hold its value, particularly if these emerging markets fail and also if European currency falls into pieces.
And what about the effect on inflation and interest rates, Alistair? Do you see all of the forces that you've been discussing as causing a sort of stagflationary environment?
Yes, the thing is that China is stockpiling all these resources. I'm told by people who have been there recently that if you go to Shanghai, the place is going like a train. It's incredible what's going through Shanghai.
Yes,
and really, China has got the whole of sub-Saharan Africa dancing to her tune.
Yes,
she's got Russia supplying resources. She's tied up oil from Saudi Arabia. She's also tied up oil from Iran. She's tied up copper from Chile and from Indonesia. I mean, it's really remarkable the effect that China is having on the global supply of raw materials and energy. And what this means is that the idea that if you get a recession in America, demand for these raw materials goes down, and because companies reduce their margins and all the rest of it, you find that prices start falling on a recession. Not this time. I don't see it. I think that the raw material prices are rising, will continue to rise. Now, this is precisely the conditions that you have with the stagflation, that you see your own economy going absolutely nowhere, yet prices are rising. And guess what? People are latching onto the idea that actually the purchasing power of their currency, the domestic currency, in this case the dollar, is not holding. And on that basis, perhaps we prefer on the margins to hold fewer dollars than we would normally do, maybe to draw down on credit in order to have not an exposure to that declining currency. And when you start thinking that way, guess what? The purchasing power of the currency starts going down, irrespective of the quantity in circulation. And we also know the quantity in circulation, if we hit any road bumps, is going to increase pretty sharply as well. Why? Because that's the way fiat currencies work. So this hasn't happened before. The idea that America runs the world is no longer true. They're now playing second fiddle to what China is actually doing with the whole of Asia. And it's a fascinating situation.
With the potential of the dollar going down, could this trigger another wave of international, global competitive currency devaluations? I know, Jayant, you mentioned maybe people would want to hold dollars, but could the natural reaction by the Asian countries, for example, where you live in Southeast Asia, could their natural reaction be to counter the dollar going down by forced devaluation of their currencies? All of this would be very bullish for gold, of
course. The problem is that it won't help their economy, and they will almost certainly try that.
Yeah.
The problem is that these countries have inherent problem in their economic structures. So devaluing against the US dollar won't necessarily help them. But again, the temptation among those people will be to devalue, because that's how they have historically operated, and that's what they think works. It doesn't work, though.
And if they do that, wouldn't that make the attractiveness of commodities and gold in particular even more attractive, right, where you have the loss of purchasing power in currencies worldwide?
Absolutely, Richard. As I was saying, I increasingly get asked by Indians how they can move their money abroad and how they can own and hold gold outside the country. And I think that is increasingly becoming at least a subject of interest for people, that they want to not only buy commodities, they want to invest outside their own countries, and they want to own and hold gold outside their own country of residence. And that's what I think they should be doing.
Alistair?
Yeah, no, I agree with what Jayant's saying. I mean, from gold money's point of view, bring it on.
Yeah.
But I think, the world has changed, governments still seem to think they can push their own people around and tell them, you can't move money here or there or wherever. It doesn't work like that anymore. I mean, we've got something called the internet. We've got international payments. Like, people like gold money can do this, that, the other thing. The world has changed. And I think the amount of control that countries like India really think they've got over their peoples. I mean, they probably don't fully understand actually how fintech is changing all this. I think that's going to be a major impact. I'd also like to back up something that Jayant was saying about the other Southeast Asian currencies. I mean, traditionally, the dollar's been, if you like, the sort of the cleanest shirt in a dirty laundry. I mean, if you look at most of the currencies around Southeast Asia, I mean, not just sort of India, Pakistan, but going into Indonesian rupiah, for example. I mean, the loss of purchasing power of these currencies since the Nixon shock back in 1970 has been really absolutely incredible. I mean, the rupiah has lost well over 99% of its value since then. And the story has been similar with most of the other currencies. So I think when the dollar goes down in terms of its purchasing power, I would certainly see other currencies tending to lose their purchasing power on balance more rapidly. And I think also the euro has the potential for disintegration. And now what's going to happen when the euro disintegrates, I really don't know. But the political developments in Europe certainly are pointing to that being an escalating risk in 2017.
Yeah, I remember in Indonesia, I was there in 96 working on a startup for Schlumberger, and it was about 2,000 rupiah for one U.S. dollar, and I think it's now 11,000 or 12,000, 14,000, sort of fluctuates. So that's a significant, like, sevenfold decrease in just less than 20 years.
Well, I was out there earlier this year, and I can't remember the rate. What the rate was? I mean, it's just so many noughts. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah. Just final thoughts, Shayant.
One thing what Alistair was talking about China, and I want to add to what he was saying. Alistair was talking about accumulation of capital that is happening in China. What I see, Richard, and I go to China quite often. What I see very interesting is a huge accumulation of intellectual capital happening in China. You go to bookshops, now they have multi-story bookshops around the country, and you get books written in Chinese, and these are books translated from English to Chinese. So what I see is a huge intellectual accumulation, capital accumulating in that country. You see coffee shops, you see restaurants, you see offices trying to follow and copy the Western ways of working. And that's something that makes me very optimistic about China in the future.
Very interesting. And final thoughts from you, Alistair?
Yeah, well, I find what Jan's just said absolutely fascinating. I mean, it's very nice to have the confirmation of my thoughts from someone who's actually sort of on the ground, goes there, sees it, feels it, and all the rest of it. And I think you know, the point here is we really are missing. The big trick we're missing is that the future, I mean, you know, if I had a son, I mean, more my sons are too old now. Okay. They're all established here. I had a son, say, 18, who said, "Dad, what should I do? Where should I go?" I'd say, "Go on, Asia." I mean, go and talk to the Chinese. Go and talk. Yeah. See what they're doing in Asia. This is so exciting. And I really just don't see how India can stay out of it. If India actually smartens its act up together, stops messing around with its people and its money, and actually begins to think, we've got to be a bit more constructive. We've got to work with the Chinese, because that is where the power is. I mean, they're already sort of there, because they've had long-standing relations with Russia. The Asian continent, that's where the excitement is. I'm sorry to say this, but Europe in its current guise and America is history.
Yes, indeed. And I believe now it's at the point of 90% of all engineers, scientists are now Asians living in Asia.
Yes. And every time I turn on the television, there's someone from Morgan Stanley or from, you know, wherever. I mean, you know, it's actually a very bright Asian, you know, who's doing the commentary.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's wonderful. I really do think it's wonderful.
Yeah. Great. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Jayant?
I have a website, Richard, www.jayantbhandari.com, and everything I do is on that website.
Excellent. And Alistair?
Go to goldmoney.com and click on Wealth. And underneath Wealth, you'll find that there's insights and market reports. I write a weekly insight piece, which is published sort of mid-morning, I suppose, Eastern Standard Time, and a market report, which I do on Friday morning, which is released at about the same time on the Friday.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your great insights, fascinating commentary. We'll do it again.
Indeed.
Thank you very much.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.